Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss Prince Harry's beef with the tabloid press, banning phones for under-16s, and whether support for prohibitionism should be protected under the Equality Act. Hello, and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Tom. Hi, listeners.
And we're delighted to be joined on the show today by Mick Hume, known to many of our listeners, I'm sure, as a Spiked columnist, the launch editor here at Spiked, and the author of many books. But we're going to talk specifically about his book and the issue of press freedom today. Mick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hello.
So, Mick, let's start with you, because one issue which I think is often neglected in our discussions around freedom of speech and free expression is the issue of press freedom, something that you've written extensively about. And it's kind of creeping back into the news agenda in a way that many people might not have noticed. So there's a couple of things I want to talk with you about today. But the first off being the way in which the sort of anti-press freedom campaign has found a new figurehead in the form of Prince Harry. He's had a number of litigations against various newspaper groups. Most recently in December, he settled one case against the Mirror Group newspapers, publishers of the Daily Mirror, etc. I was just wondering if you'd tell us a bit about that particular case and what you think it reveals about the fight for press freedom at the moment.
Yes. Well, just go back to the first thing you said, Tom, about the way that freedom of the press is often kind of sidelined in discussions of free speech. I think it's very important because if we don't have freedom of the press, then freedom of speech is practically meaningless, right? You've got to have the ability to actually publish and say what you want to say to the world. The current attitude to it is kind of summed up for me by Tom Stoppard wrote a play a few years ago that I used a quote from at the beginning of my free speech book that I wrote around the Leveson Inquiry, where one character's talking about is praising the glories of the of freedom of the press and how important it is for democracy. And the other one says, yes, I'm with you on the freedom of the press. It's the newspapers I can't stand. And that's the kind of attitude we have. You know, it's like John Cleese is now a hero of free speech because he defends the right of comedians to be offensive. But John Cleese is also a platform spokesman for Hacked Off, the celebrity-fronted campaign that wants state control of the press. So there's a kind of attitude that we should have freedom of the speech for Cambridge-educated comedians, but not necessarily for Sun journalists. And I think that's a very dangerous kind of thing, because we understand freedom of speech as being indivisible and freedom of the press as its practical expression. We've got to stand up for it. Right, the Prince Harry cases. Harry's thing is, you know, as Piers Morgan rightly points out, Harry insists that only he has the right to interfere in and publicise the privacy of his family, and he objects to the press doing it, and he's been pursuing these cases for some years, which he says is not just about, because they always say this, it's not just about me, it's a mission. I'm on a mission to reform the British press, by which he means to sanitise and tame the tabloids in particular. And he won this important case in December, and has since the Mirror Group has since kind of taken the knee and given in to all of his demands, despite the fact that even the judge who found in his favour said there was virtually no evidence, and indeed there was no evidence at all, of Harry's phone being hacked. In fact, when Harry appeared in court earlier last year, he said he was asked by the Mirror News Group's newspapers lawyers if there was any evidence he'd been hacked, and he said, no, that's the reason I'm here, my lud. I've come to court to find some evidence on which to base my case, which is a very interesting kind of reversal of the way that court cases normally work. But nevertheless, the judge found in his favour and awarded him damages and so on. It's not a big blow for the freedom of the press to publish what those in positions of power and influence don't want published. And I think it's a very dangerous trend we're on. And Harry's really a kind of become this poster boy, despite the fact that he's a gormless and in many ways a ridiculed figure. He remains this poster boy for the very elitist campaign from people who hate the popular media and the popular press. And the reason that they hate them is because they really hate the populace and they don't trust people. And they think that the popular media manipulates people and makes them vote Tory and makes them vote for Brexit and do things which are against the better interests of our society. The other thing to note about all these cases that Harry's been involved in, of course, is that they're all based on privacy laws. And this is why this case is about much more than Prince Harry and Piers Morgan. It's about freedom of the press it's also about democracy, because the British Parliament has never passed a privacy law. There is no such proposal ever been passed in British Parliament. What they passed was the Human Rights Act under Tony Blair, which judges have used to invent privacy laws by saying that when they weigh up the right to freedom of expression against the right to a family life, they find in favour of family life and privacy. So we've got judge-made laws being used to restrict the freedom of what we can and can't publish in the press. I think this is a very dangerous road we're going down for, not only for free speech, but for democracy itself.
And as you were talking there about the fear of the populace, it's been fascinating how clearly Prince Harry has articulated that particular snobbish position. I mean, I've trawled through his 55-page witness document that accompanied his case. And he blames the press for... He essentially has a kind of paranoid fantasy that all of the stories in the press about him just being a bit dim, for instance, has the potential to incite violence against him. There's this bizarre passage in which he imagines a situation in which someone walks up to him and says, "Oi, I know you, you're an idiot, I'm now going to stab you." That's almost a direct quote. So again, in his quite idiotic fashion, it's been a very clear expression of all of those prejudices that exist. Do you think there's an added irony here, Mick, that it's a prince who has become the figurehead for this, given that the fight for press freedom really began with the fight to be able to mock and ridicule the royal family, essentially?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, Tom, he blames all the problems of his life, including the death of his mother, of course, he blames on the press, and particularly the tabloid press. He used an expression in court, which you know that he's been briefed by all of these campaigners, because it's what they always say. He was asked, don't you think there was a public interest in reporting the fact that you were doing drugs all the time, given that you were at the time, whatever it was, third in line to the throne? And he said, there's a difference between the public interest and what's of interest to the public. And that's the kind of classic kind of snobbish view of these things, which is taken by all campaigners on these issues, that the public interest is something which should be defined by judges and Guardian editors and not by the public who want to read about this stuff in the press. I completely agree with you about the irony of it being a prince. You know, until the end of the 17th century, we had the crown licensing of the press, where nothing could be published in Britain without the permission of the appointees of the monarch. And that didn't end until 1695. And the fact that you've now got a prince leading a kind of crusade to impose new law-backed restrictions on the press is a historical irony for anybody's eyes.
Absolutely. And I want to come on in one moment to the way in which state-backed regulation is crept back in. But first of all, I'd be remiss if I didn't give Chris a free hit at Prince Harry, as is everyone's right on this podcast. But Chris, what have you made of this whole circus?
Yeah, well, I've got the words Prince Harry muted on Twitter, so I don't really know what he does. I am the opposite of what Prince Harry thinks the general public and the press are like. I'm not interested in whatsoever or his wife. So I don't actually know really what this story is about. What's Piers Morgan been saying about him, or what the Mirror been reporting? Are we even allowed to say it, or will we get sued if we mention it? What's the story here, I suppose, is what I'm asking. Not the broader story of press freedom, but literally what they've been saying about Prince Harry.
Mick, I know that it comes down to, I think, 15 particular stories which were deemed to be kind of unlawfully sourced, effectively. But are there any kind of standout examples from the Mirror Group case that you want to highlight?
No, not really. They're really pathetic, Tom. I mean, he first of all wanted to 100 historical stories going right back to the 90s. Most of this is very historical stuff, and actually, by normal standards, some of the other celebrities that were involved in the case with him have had their cases thrown out by the same judges because they're too old. They've taken too long to come to court. Harry had some ridiculous story about there being a conspiracy by the palace to stop him bringing them to court earlier, and so he'd been delayed. So he wanted 100-odd stories about everything from his ex-girlfriends to his drug taking to, you know, dressing up as a Nazi in fancy dress and all of these things. And he was claiming that all these stories had been gained by illegal activities. Finally, it came down to, they said they would look at about 30 of them. And the judge said 15 of them were marginal. You know, there had been some limited form of unlawful activity involved in taking them. But there was no evidence of any hacking of Harry's phone, for example. Nevertheless, he found in his favour. So it's really Harry demanding that he should have control, using privacy law to control what his own public. You know, it's not that they want privacy. Obviously, him and his wife don't want privacy. What they want is control of their public image. And that's the kind of danger then of what happens to the public discussion of scandals and allegations, is that the press becomes far less willing to report anything that they think might get them into trouble when these kind of cases are the consequence of it. After this case, he came out and said, and through his lawyer, that actually Piers Morgan should be investigated by the police, and there should be criminal prosecutions against everybody who'd been involved in this stuff. So, you know, his mission is far from over, and there are some quite powerful people behind him.
Well, obviously, I agree with you on your basic point about press freedom, Mick, but it seems to me it would be quite good if the press were scared off reporting anything about Prince Harry and his stupid wife. Yeah, just that narrow issue. And it would also really upset them too, wouldn't it, in the end, if everyone completely ignored them. They need to be sent to Coventry, the pair of them. No one cares. I mean, the reason I think he's banging on about this, it's he's constantly looking for attention, right? And now isn't he saying he's going to sort of get back in with the royal family to support his dad with his cancer? That'll just be to get some more anecdotes for his next book.
I think the press should ignore him, Chris. I agree with you, but that's not the same thing as having a judge tell the press that they've got to ignore him. And this is the distinction of all these things, right? Like you, I am not interested in Prince Harry stories in their own terms, but I support the right of the press to make an editorial judgment that that's a story that their readers are interested in, and that's quite different from having a judge sitting literally in Solomon-like judgment and saying this is news that can be reported and that's news that can't be, and that's where I think the danger is in it, and we shouldn't be kind of misled by the pettiness of some of the stories, but to miss the kind of bigger issue that's at stake when we're letting judges edit the news, or Prince Harry edit the news, which is effectively what it comes down to.
And I know we want to move on to some nanny state stories, but before we do that, Mick, I just wondered if you could talk briefly about Section 40. Because again, because press freedom is something which isn't discussed that much, I don't think many people will be aware of what has been going on in relation to the attempt to regulate the press, in particular, basically since Leveson, there was this Section 40 of the Crime and Courts Act, which effectively tried to strong-arm newspapers into signing up to state-backed regulation of the press. It's something that the Tories have, up until this point, just refused to implement, not least because there was such backlash from campaigners when it's brought out to consultation. It now seems like they're actually primed to abolish it entirely, but naturally there's pushback from the Labour Party. Do you want to tell us a bit about what Section 40 is and what's at stake there?
Yeah, so as you say, unknown but important measure. Lord Leveson's inquiry, which was supposed to be into phone hacking in 2012, turned into an investigation, as he put it, of the entire ethics and practices of the British media, and came down. It was basically a show trial of the tabloid press, where the verdict was decided before things had even started. And it basically came down in the end to a call for state-backed regulation of the press. And they created this regulator, which no one's ever heard of, called Impress, and which is backed by the Privy Council and the monarchy, and you're supposed to sign up to this to be an officially regulated press. Now, none of the press wanted anything to do with it, so no publication worth its salt has ever signed up to Impress. So what Section 40, which was sneaked in through the House of Lords, was and attached to a crime act, which is Section 40 of a bill that's got nothing to do with it. What it said was that if a publication was not signed up to Impress, to the state-backed regulator, and went to court, even if they won the case, they would have to pay the costs of both parties. Right? It's a complete blackmail measure put against the press to make them sign up to the official regulator. And this was called at the time a carrot to induce the newspaper publishers to sign up to the new regulation system. I remember writing at the time that if that was a carrot, it was a carrot shaped like a baseball bat with a 9-inch nail banged through the end of it, because it was there to beat them into submission. To their credit, none of them still agreed. So Section 40 was passed through Parliament but never implemented. So it's been kind of lurking in the shadows, waiting to be brought in, particularly waiting for a Labour government to come and bring it in. And the Tories promised in their 2019 manifesto to abolish it altogether. And like many things promised in that manifesto, this never happened, except that now, finally, in the media bill that's just been passed, Section 40 is removed from the statute book. So that is a bit of good news as far as press freedom is concerned, a rare bit of good news that we should be happy about. The Labour Party, who swore beforehand that they would bring it back, are now saying, no, we're not going to do that, because obviously Keir Starmer's in this general kind of, we don't want to rock the boat position before general election. We don't want to cause trouble with the media, etc. We'll see what happens once Labour are, if as expected, in power later this year, and if some similar measure doesn't come back in, because there are an awful lot of people in the Labour Party who would love to see that baseball bat brought back in to beat the press into submission. We'll see. But as I say, but for the time being, at least, a little bit of good news. These campaigners, by the way, people often say, well, what do you mean? What's wrong with regulation? Well, obviously, as you say, we haven't had state-regulated press since 1695. We don't want to go back to that. But I remember debating around the Leveson Inquiry and Section 40 with the hacked off people. I've debated Hugh Grant, debated all of them quite a lot of times. And they said to me, one of the professors supporting state regulation to the press said to me, the idea of an unregulated press is otherplanetary. So I said to them, do you mean that other planet, the United States, where they have an unregulated press, where they have the First Amendment to the Constitution, which says that Congress shall introduce no law interfering with the freedom of the press or freedom of speech? So that's the kind of gold standard we're looking for if you want to talk about legal regulation of the press. We're a long way from that in this country, but at least the potential abolition of Section 40, and we'll see what happens when it goes to the Lords if they try and turn it around again, but the potential abolition of Section 40 finally, 5 years later, would be a very good thing.
Definitely. If anyone's looking to try and understand this issue a bit deeper, I really recommend Mick's book, There Is No Such Thing as a Free Press, and we need one more than ever. It's really useful, not only on Leveson, but also the whole history of the fight for press freedom. But Chris, shall we move on to the nanny state section of the podcast and some of the stories that you picked out? One that really jumped out was this idea that being pro-prohibitionism is looking to be recognized as a protected philosophical belief. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, this is an extraordinary story, right? There's a lot going on in this story, so focus. It is a bit weird. So there's a guy called Professor Jim McCambridge, who I've been familiar with for quite a long time because he writes endless articles in journals, but mostly about the alcohol industry, but all about how the alcohol industry has sort of webs of influence and how it gets its way in public policy making by lying, basically. And he trolls through consultation responses and looks at the so-called tactics and strategies of the alcohol industry, also the tobacco and food and gambling, any vice he doesn't like. And his basic theory is that every industry he doesn't like uses so-called tobacco tactics, right? So he's made a career from this somehow. And he's a genuine fanatic. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about that, as this story will illustrate. So he's at York University. This other academic called Neil McKegany, who is mainly interested in drug research, he runs something called the Centre for Substance Misuse, I think, at Glasgow University. He hooked up with some people at York University. I don't think he ever actually got tenure at York, but he was involved in a project about essentially evaluating various ways of getting prisoners off drugs. Okay, it was a three-year project associated and I guess technically based at the university. Now, this guy, Neil McKegany, he has also done research into smoking and vaping, and he has received funding from vape and tobacco manufacturers for some of his research, although it's not the main, it's not his main area of interest. And this project at York University had nothing to do with tobacco or vaping at all. It was just about illegal drugs. So evidently, this Jim McCambridge character, he then sent various emails around to the higher-ups complaining about this guy having an association with York University and claiming quite improbably that this could lead to more people smoking because, a young person thinking about smoking might go to the York University website and see that this guy is doing some research into prisoners and illicit drugs and then chase up his conflicts of interest and then go, oh, might as well start smoking. Clearly, York University is in favor of that. So he sent some emails that I imagine were pretty weird to the higher ups. And then, unrelatedly, he got investigated for bullying and harassment of three students. And after a prolonged investigation, the university found that he was indeed guilty of bullying and harassment. He has now gone to an employment tribunal claiming, in effect, that when he was complaining about Neil McAgany having something to do with York University. He was effectively a whistleblower, and that because he blew the whistle, he was then treated harshly when students complained about him bullying and harassing them. Are you with me so far? Furthermore, he is claiming that his kind of fanatical belief, which essentially boils down to the fact that no element of the tobacco industry should have any say whatsoever on research or public policy or anything else, his belief that the tobacco industry and anybody associated with them should be ostracized from society is a philosophical belief protected under the Equality Act. So you've got various weird threads going through this. And this came up in the news recently because the judge at the initial preliminary hearing was asked to throw it out by the university. The university said this has no chance of success. It's ridiculous. You know, let's nip it in the bud now. The judge said that although I'm not saying it has a strong chance of success, it probably has some chance of success. So this is now going to go ahead. And potentially, I mean, certainly if this guy wins and he gets his bizarre beliefs to be recognized under the Equality Act, then anything can be recognized under the Equality Act, except, I guess, mainstream beliefs. They'll be the only things that don't get special protection. Yeah. But this came only a week after David Miller, the notorious David Miller, who had been sacked for his so-called anti-Zionist beliefs at Bristol, and another complete and utter conspiracy theorist, and a conspiracy theorist, as is so often the way, that often ends up focusing on Jewish people. He got his anti-Zionist beliefs, which were that, you know, Zionism is a genocidal, murderous, whatever system. He got that recognized under the Equality Act, and I think got his dismissal sort of overturned, or was declared as unlawful in some way. So this is actually, although it's a very odd and, you know, quite funny case, and probably doesn't have that much chance of success, it just shows that the Equality Act really does need to be abolished. You know, it surely, well, yeah, even the most good-willed advocates of the Equality Act when it was created surely didn't intend it to be used for these kind of purposes.
Mick, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, as Chris says, Tom, it's truly bizarre. It's kind of, you know, cancel culture eating itself. Somebody who wants other people sacked for their belief, insisting that his right to say that should be a protected belief under the Equalities Act. Utterly bizarre. And yet, as Chris also indicates, an entirely logical end of the Equalities Act. And this relates back to our previous discussion about who should decide who gets... Because I think that cranks and anti-Semites and these kind of people should have freedom of speech. We should call them out and expose them and see what they stand for. But what the Equality Act does is it establishes a list of things which are protected beliefs. In other words, it's the opposite of the First Amendment attitude from America, which I just was talking about, which is it's what they call content neutral, supposedly. You don't judge speech on what is actually said. You just say, unless it's a direct incitement to criminal activity, there is freedom of speech for all shades of opinion. What this does is says these beliefs are protected, and which ones are protected will be decided by judges and others in tribunals and court cases. So it goes back to our previous discussion about, as soon as you start talking about freedom of speech being limited in some way, the question is where you draw the line and who is going to draw it. The Equalities Act has got to go, because it's doing the opposite of facilitating discussion. You get bizarre cases like this, which have much broader implications, as Chris indicates, in terms of, you know, saying that these beliefs are protected, but a belief like supporting Israel's right to defend itself, for example, or other controversial mainstream, what would once have been mainstream views, will not enjoy the same protection. So free speech, yes. Equalities Act, no.
It sort of takes like a Roman law approach to it, doesn't it? It's, you know, you can have a system in which you say all beliefs are protected, which is essentially the American, but, you know, the constitutional system. You can have a system in which all characteristics are protected. What we have with the current sort of progressive system is a system in which everything is effectively unprotected, and then you start going through and finding different people and different opinions that you want to give special protection to. until it ends up inevitably being the most mainstream normal characteristics and beliefs that are left unprotected, and all the unusual or wacky beliefs that aren't. And inevitably, that just leads to a different form of discrimination.
Absolutely. I mean, it's worth saying that in recent years, people have been reaching for the Equality Act as a means to protect themselves against their employers, particularly with the gender-critical feminists. Obviously, everyone thinks about the Maya Forstatter case, in which she successfully fought back against her sacking for her gender-critical views. But it's worth remembering that many of these are kind of Pyrrhic victories, in a sense, because of the fact that something like the Forstatter case could very easily have gone the other way. I mean, originally, they found against her and suggested that her view wasn't acceptable in a democratic society. But moving on, Chris, let's talk about the next story that you picked out today, which is about vaping allegedly causing cancer, has been claimed. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this?
Oh, well, lots of people have made that claim. When I was in Panama, actually, a couple of weeks ago, some of the delegates at the World Health Organization conference were handing around this mock-up of an e-cigarette, like a disposable e-cigarette, which says on it explicitly, vaping causes cancer. The particular story that caught my eye was some weirdo over in Tasmania who's sort of a veteran tobacco control activist. You know, in Australia, they're all completely deranged about vaping. They'll believe anything at all. It's a proper full-on panic there. And she has put up this big 7-foot-tall banner she's created herself with a picture of a guy's horrible, his mouth, you know, his a cancerous tongue, basically, it turns out to be. And like a graphic warning on cigarette pack kind of thing. And it says above it, e-cigarettes kill, e-cigarettes cause heart disease, cancer, and something else. And this, I didn't know where this came from. I thought this maybe you should just pick this image off the internet. It actually comes from a study, if you can call it that, published in Pediatrics a couple of years ago, which was just a case report. Now, case reports, if you don't know, they're quite useful to doctors. They generally look at one specific example of somebody, often with an unusual illness, and it describe how it progressed and so on. So this focuses entirely on one guy, one 19-year-old guy in America, who bit his tongue quite badly, and it started swelling up, and there was an abscess there. And very sadly, he was then diagnosed with mouth cancer, and he was dead of a heart attack within 6 months. A sad story, but a very unusual case indeed. It's very, very rare for people under the age of 20 to get mouth cancer, for a start off. And it turned out he was a former smoker, but hadn't smoked for a while, he said. He said he didn't take drugs, but he started smoking marijuana after his diagnosis, and he was a vapor. Okay, so that was all they knew. He was a vapor who had got mouth cancer. So, you know, post-op, ergo propter hoc. The authors of this study, who were clearly very biased against vaping, the title of the study itself was Vaping the Venom, which doesn't strike me as a very professional or academic title. It's much more tabloidy than you might expect from a scientific journal. They essentially conclude, you know, they couch it in just enough doubt to, you know, get through the peer review process, but they basically say vaping probably causes guy's mouth cancer. That is obviously not how you do science, but it is only a case report. But kind of inevitably, I guess, when anti-vaping campaigners get hold of information like that, before you know it, this poor guy's photo is up on a banner and being tweeted around the world. You do not make causal claims based on one instance. The only way that you can say that vaping doesn't cause various diseases would be if vapors never got the diseases at all. You know, if that's the hurdle that needs to be crossed, that no vapor ever gets a disease, because otherwise we're going to blame it on vaping, then there's really no hope for science. Obviously, the only way you could establish whether vaping causes oral cancer, which of course it may do, it's an open question. It's not impossible that vaping would increase the risk of oral cancer. But you at least start from asking the question, yeah, has there been a rise in oral cancer amongst young people since vaping became popular? Are vapors as a whole, when you look at lots of them, are they more likely to get oral cancer than non-vapors? That's how you do the science. You don't just pick one poor, unfortunate guy and essentially exploit his death. But this is the very, very low standard of proof that's now seems to be acceptable, not just amongst this particular weirdo in Tasmania, but amongst delegates at World Health Organization conferences.
Mick, anything to add on vaping before we move on to banning phones?
Well, yeah, I mean, that story is like, it reminds you of what happened during the pandemic, you know, when anybody that died within reaching distance of somebody who might have had COVID was said to be a COVID-related death. It's like, this is, we've now got vaping-related deaths, you know, somebody vapes and whatever they die of, vaping has got to be a cause of it. It really brings home to me, as much that Chris has written about this stuff, that anything that is called public health policy ends up being about controlling private behaviour. And it's so clearly that the vaping thing began, if we remember, as hailed as an anti-smoking measure, something that would stop people smoking, which are genuinely harmful cigarettes, by switching to other forms of nicotine delivery, and was hailed as a pro-health measure. And immediately the public health lobby is saying, well, we can't have that. That would be people doing things that's outside of our control. And so we've got to start delegitimizing it in all of these ways. And it's gone on ever since. And now we've got the bans coming in Britain and everything. And it's like, when I gave up smoking, chain smoking, when I was 30, many, many years ago, I had to clean out all the sweet shops of Hackney of all of the lollipops they had and suck them to fix my oral craving and give up smoking players number six. I would love to have had vapes as a way of helping me do it. And the fact that they've now been effectively criminalized is itself a kind of criminal indictment of the public health industry.
Should we move on to talking about banning phones, which is something that we haven't discussed yet in too much depth on this podcast, but it's become a much bigger political issue. So this is the discussion about smartphones and teenagers primarily. So in recent weeks, Miriam Cates, the Conservative MP, has made some headlines by calling for smartphones for the under 16s to be banned. There's been broader interest in this because of the case of Brianna Jai, the murdered teenager. Esther Jai has said that she thinks that smartphones should be banned, that this has basically raised the issue of mental health amongst kids in general. There's also Ian Russell, who people might remember as the father of the teenager Molly Russell, who very sadly took her own life after supposedly being kind of bombarded on social media with self-harm material and so on. In that case, I think actually, in quite dubious circumstances, social media was actually mentioned as almost a kind of contributor to her death, which is a bit of a departure and a bit concerning. But Chris, to kick us off, what do you make of this call to ban smartphones for the under 16s?
It's not a good idea, and it's not obviously going to work. I mean, how are you actually going to police this? I personally do not like young kids being on social media very much. I think you can certainly have too much of it. And I dare say there is bullying goes on in social media, but it strikes me that if the bullying didn't go on social media, it would go on face-to-face, which is probably even worse. I think my main objection to this is the rise of shroud waving as a basis for public policy, you know, and people don't want to take on bereaved parents, but unfortunately it has to be done if they're going to keep, you know, pushing for prohibitions based on the fact that they can use their grief as a kind of shield. And maybe they're being exploited by other nefarious actors. But obviously, you know, you want to hear these people's stories, but they shouldn't get a free pass to, you know. You end up with some law named after a murdered child, right? And those kind of laws are very rarely any good. Hard cases make bad law, right? There's an absolute truism. You can't make policy in the heat of the moment. And in the Brianna case, I don't even understand what the link is. Right, I mean, that murder wasn't plotted on social media, as far as I can tell. I read a reasonable amount about the case. Yes, she, Brianna herself, was on social media all the time, but from what I can gather, it's because she didn't have many friends, you know, and she would have been much lonelier had she not been on social media. So as with quite a few cases like this, the David Amos one, obviously, you know, there was absolutely no link to social media. But for some reason, it comes down to we need to police social media and stop people being mean to MPs. A whole load of legislation these days seems to be based around not, you know, stopping people being mean to MPs. Maybe the MPs should get off social media. Perhaps that's the answer.
Yeah, I was going to use the same classic showing our age phrase as Chris, hard cases make bad law, you know, which it seems to have been forgotten now as in this kind of rush to create laws named after every terrible tragedies and horrible things that happen. There's another thing that where the government have introduced this, are introducing guidance for schools saying that they should ban And, you know, a lot of this stuff comes to, and some of the better teachers have been saying, well, we already do that in our school. We already have that control. And it's really the kind of the blunt instrument of the law is being thrust into a situation where it's really about parents and teachers and adults having some kind of authority over what happens to the young people in their lives. And the blunt instrument of the law is not the best way of doing that. It's more a much wider cultural problem, I think, of us having lost the distinction between adults and children and the ability to have authority over them. One of the things that always worries me is, you know, we begin by saying we need some prohibition or other to protect the children. And obviously nobody's against protecting the children, but then what the next stage is, and therefore in order to protect the children, we have to prohibit these things for adults. And so the children become kind of human shields in a kind of onward marching campaign to limit the freedom of adults to make their own decisions. I think that's the other dangerous trend that this is always underlying in these discussions.
And sort of links in with the vaping thing as well, which has now been banned for everyone because they're worried about young
exactly,
people, isn't it?
Exactly.
But is there not, I think this is another example of something I said on the podcast a while ago, that all Tory party policy is actually about Rishi Sunak and his family. I think it's because, you know, he's got these daughters, hasn't he, about 11, 13, something like that, exactly the kind of age you're concerned about kids being on social media, exactly the kind of age my daughter is, and I don't like her being on bloody Snapchat. I won't let her download TikTok. But there's not a lot, actually, you can do about it. If it's not one social media app, it'd be a different one. I think this is probably just another Rishi policy in which he's just living his best life and doing all the things he wants because he's paranoid about what his daughters are going to get up to.
I'm trying to think what could be next. You know, we've already got mandatory Peloton.
Well, we've done vaping.
What else is he into?
He does. I mean, you could look at it a different way. You could just say that Rishi Sunak hates children. I mean, it could just be as simple as that. You know, like, no smoking from, no vaping from, no social media, but maths until you're 18.
Perhaps he had a very unhappy childhood.
It could be. One way or the other, it all comes down to Rishi Sunak, I think. He seems determined, apart from anything else, to get the number of Conservative voters who are under the age of 21 down to zero. I don't think he's far off as it stands, is he? But it does look like a real war against the youth.
We are fast running out of time, but Mick, I just want to ask one last question to you, which is one that we've taken to asking our guests, although I've forgotten to ask it in the last couple of episodes, which some eagle-eared listeners have pointed out, is that if you had to have one ban, what would it be? So obviously everyone on this podcast is very anti-ban, as a matter of principle. But if you could, in a sort of dictator for a day, if there's one thing as petty as possible, please, that you would like to clamp down upon because it just irks you, what would it be?
Well, I would like to ban VAR, video refereeing reviews, from football. It was introduced by a bunch of technocrats, the kind of technocratic solution to the problems of controversial decisions. And we were assured that it would remove all controversy from the game. Unfortunately, of course, you've still got a bunch of idiots reviewing the videos and coming up with incomprehensible decisions. So I think a ban on VAR and all technologies other than goal line technology from football would be a good thing for sport.
I dare say that'd be a very popular choice. Mick, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.